Welcome to tonight's presentation about Julian of Norwich. As you heard this morning at Matins, Julian was a 14th century mystic, a visionary, who saw Jesus as our mother, love as the basis of creation, and the universe as a hazelnut in the hand of God. She was probably the first woman to write a book in English. She insisted that God is at work among humanity as it is, not among saints in stained glass windows, but in the human race as it works and lives and loves and creates and dies. She was commemorated as a saint for the first time in the Church of England only as recently as May 8, 1980. She was born in 1342. She was probably educated by the nuns at Carrow and Benedictine Priory, although she claimed to be unlettered, perhaps meaning that she didn't know Latin. At age 31, during a severe illness, she received a series of 16 showings of God. She became a woman dedicated to religion and lived permanently alone in a cell attached to St. Julian's Church in Norwich. She probably took her name from the church, which would then have been about 400 years old. For 20 years, she meditated on the visions she had received and finally recorded them and their meaning in her book, The Revelations of Divine Love, which is now acknowledged as one of the great classics of spiritual literature. Tonight's presentation was put together by Cora Hartley of Manson, Washington, as a musical interpretation of Sheila Upjohn's play, Mind Out of Time, which was written in the 1970s. The musical selections interspersed between the three scenes will be introduced as we go. The text of the opening solo, Ai triste vida corporal, which you just heard, is translated to mean, ah, life here on earth is sad and cruel when there is nothing to give the heart to. The music and the text, whose composers are unknown, are from a mystery play of the 14th century, which is still performed today in Spain. The next piece, Mariam Matrum, whose composer is also unknown, was composed in order that pilgrims to the sanctuary at Montserrat in 14th century Spain should not disturb those who came to pray and meditate. The text reads, Mary, Virgin Mother of Jesus Christ, Sacred Mary, hear me, defend me, Jesus, be my refuge.
Thank you. Oil for lamps, 6 shillings. Wax for candles, 3 pounds. 2 dozen rabbits, 5 shillings 2d. 3 pigs, 10 shillings. Bah! What have I come to? Keeping household accounts after all the glorious work I used to do. I gave my life to...
Life?
Yes, my life was given to beauty and joy for the soul. Holy words and pictures in capital letters. Gold leaf and lapis lazuli. Like jewels on the floor of heaven.
Holy words on the floor of heaven?
Holy words.
You must mean Latin.
Latin, yes, and English, too. I remember one of the last manuscripts I ever copied. It was English, funny, old-fashioned English, honest and homely. Written by a woman, it was.
A woman?
Her name was Julian, an anchorite here in Norwich.
What's an anchorite?
Anchoress, actually. Anchorites and anchoresses are religious men and women who live as hermits, by themselves, and devote their lives to prayer. Julian lived in a room beside the church without even a door, only windows. One opened into the church sanctuary so she could listen to the service, and another where a servant could bring food and clean clothes and empty the slops, and where people could ask her advice. She gave up her physical freedom in order to find spiritual freedom in God's service.
And to write words?
Indeed she did.
What words?
God forbid that you should say or take it that I'm a teacher, for I do not mean that, nor never meant it. I'm an unlettered woman, poor and simple, but I know well that what I say, I have it from the showing of him that is a mighty teacher. And I tell it to you for love, for I would to God it were known, and my fellow Christians helped on to greater loathing of sin and loving of God. But because I am a woman, must I therefore believe that I should not tell you of the goodness of God, when I saw at the same time that it was his will that it should be known? You shall see in what follows if I have understood well and truly. Then you shall soon forget me, who am of no account, and behold Jesus, who is teacher of all.
The next piece, the Magnificat of Mary, is set to a plain song tune that is found in the Lutheran Book of Worship in a service of evening prayer. It will be sung by a small choir.
My soul proclaims your greatness.
To read in Julian's day. And even in Brother John's, he didn't rush into print without very good reason. Even so, there must have been hundreds of handwritten copies of Julian's book in religious houses up and down the country. But at the dissolution of the monasteries, every single one of them disappeared. For more than a century, it looked as though Julian's book had never been written. And then one copy turned up, in France of all places. Goodness knows how it got there, but it got as far as the Bibliothèque Nationale, and it was printed for the first time in 1670. It didn't make much of a stir. Times had changed since Julian lived in King Street. The Tudors had come and gone, then the first of the Stuarts, Charles I. He had been deposed and executed. Cromwell's men had marched into Norwich, and once more the churches had been stripped and looted, again for very high-minded reasons. The English, or the British, I should say, had had enough of being a republic and invited Charles II back as king. When Julian's book first appeared in print, it was only 10 years since his restoration. Puritanism was out of fashion. The court glittered, the theaters were open, and people were more in the mood to listen to the new playwright Wycherley than to a long-dead nun from Norwich. The years went by, and still no copy of the book appeared in England. And then Sir Hans Sloane died. Who was he? A most interesting man. He had been George II's doctor and a keen amateur botanist. He bought the manor of Chelsea and founded a botanical garden there, which is why Sloane Square and Hans Crescent are called after him. But more important of all, from our point of view, is that during his life, he built up a huge collection of books and manuscripts. When he died, they were bought by the British Museum, and there, among all the papers, were two copies of Julian's book. Not that the British Museum realized what they'd got for quite some time. Although they'd bought the Sloane collection in 1753, they didn't get around to cataloging it until 1904. Cataloging's a job that always gets put off. So when I came across one of the copies in 1900, it was more or less by chance. I cannot pretend to be Julian's first editor. There were obscure editions, but mine was the one that put Julian back on the map. In fact, so many people wanted to read Julian's book that my edition was in print continuously from 1901 right up to 1970. So now, let's come a little more up to date.
Cora Hartley, advisor for tonight's presentation, composed the next piece in 1962. It's entitled, I Do Adore Thee, Holy Child, and is a form of a Magnificat to the child Jesus, as sung by his mother Mary.
Change and faiths change, as well as fashions. Our mental furniture is a good deal more sophisticated than the simple, serviceable stuff of the 14th century. Galileo wasn't even born in Julian's day. It was 200 years later that he first put forth the theory that the earth moves around the sun instead of the other way around. And he was imprisoned by the Inquisition for his pains. Darwin hadn't shocked the church with his Origin of Species, and a man called Sigmund Freud wasn't even a gleam in anybody's subconscious. So much has changed that it seems quite absurd to suppose that a half-educated woman who spent most of her life in one room in King Street, Norwich, can have anything at all to say to us in the second half of the 20th century. But some things change, and some things stay the same. The problem is deciding which is which. We're going to throw open the debate now to two experts in religious affairs who've been taking opposing sides since time began. Julian would have believed in them. You have to ask yourself whether you do, as characters or as concepts. Do good and evil exist? Is there a battle for the human soul? Or is it all simply a matter of adjusting your point of view? Ladies and gentlemen, may I present the Archangel Michael, the Archfiend Beelzebub, and between them, Julian of Norwich.
My dear Archangel, I must congratulate you. In my job as devil missioner with special responsibility for making the church look a fool whenever possible, I don't often get any help from your people. But your latest operation, this Julian woman, is an absolute gift.
I know you well enough, Beelzebub, to know you're going to tell me whether I ask you or not. What makes you think that telling people about Julian of Norwich is on the side of the devil?
But Michael, it's so quaint and dated. Here's this old biddy, I shall simply say decently dead and buried nearly 600 years, and the church today has nothing better to do than dig her up and make a song and dance about her.
Do you really think the minds of men have been so far betrayed that they believe that nothing can be true unless it happened yesterday?
I hope so. I've been working on it myself, and the playback I'm getting now is really very encouraging. I've been concentrating on change, 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 which, after all, is what anybody with half an eye can see what's going on all around them. And I really think I've got it to the point where they assume that because material conditions are different, then spiritual conditions must be different too.
So your story is that Julian, simply because you lived in the 1300s instead of the 1900s, is automatically irrelevant?
Everything, but everything that was said in the past, I invented myself. Had I... And I think that I shall be able to go on putting out new truths indefinitely.
Truth is a word that comes strangely from your lips, Beelzebub. Though I notice you always use it in the plural. But you and I know that truth never changes.
Personally, yes. Professionally, no.
This is your destiny, Beelzebub, continually to change your ground, continually to attack the stronghold of truth, continually to fail.
I don't fail all the time, Michael, or else you'd be out of a job. And anyway, my message always sounds so fresh and exciting. It's new. It's blue. It must be true. Whereas you're stuck with trying to put over the same old story.
But the fact that truth is eternal, forever old and forever new, is something that people finally discover, Beelzebub, simply because it is true. Their poets go on telling them, even if their priests sometimes forget. It's what T.S. Eliot said in the Four Quartets. In the last lines, he even uses Julian's words.
We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown remembered gate is that which was the beginning. At the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between the two waves of the sea. Quick now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one.
Who reads poetry these days? Or Julian, for that matter. And if what she says is a bit inconvenient, I shall simply switch over to personal abuse. It's ridiculously easy to discredit a woman, especially one who never married and spent all her life after the age of 30 in one room. I shall put it about that she was hysterical and had delusions and pretended it was divine revelation to draw attention to herself.
In all the modern rush and noise and hustle, people have got out of the habit of stopping and listening.
If you stop in most places, all that happens is you get knocked over by a bus.
Meditation and the spiritual enrichment that comes from it are back in fashion, Beelzebub. People are finding out that love thy neighbor doesn't go far enough. They're starting to remember that the whole of that commandment is love thy neighbor as thyself. And that means finding out more about yourself, your identity. And to do that, you have to remember that the greatest commandment of all is to love God.
And you seriously think that this Julian woman is going to help you?
Yes. She tells them how to find themselves.
But in this fleeting life we live here in our bodies, we do not know what ourself is, except through faith. And when we clearly and truly know and see what ourself is, then we shall clearly and truly see and know our God in the fullness of joy. And so I saw surely that it is easier for us to come to know God than to know our own soul. For our soul is so deep-rooted in God and so dearly loved that we are not able to know it until we first know God, its maker, with whom it is one. But even so, I saw that we must, to be complete, desire wisely and truly to know our own soul. And through this we are taught to seek it where it is, and that is in God.
But for years they've been encouraged to be outgoing, to be outward looking, extrovert. You'll have the devil of a job making this sort of thing respectable.
I'll agree that fashion, which you always contrive to squeeze every advantage from, has been assuming, put very badly, that outward looking is good, inward looking is bad. But time brings its revenges, and often it's the very fact that they haven't been looking inward enough that brings it home to people that they feel half-starved without it.
So, you're going to encourage them all to be mystics, are you?
Not many people have the gift to be a mystic, just as not many of them have the gift to be a musician, or a poet, or a painter. But the world needs all their special insights, and it needs the mystic's insight too. Julian knew that.
Inasmuch as you love God more than I do, then by that much you are better than I am. I say this not to those who are wise, for they know it well, but I say it to you that are simple for your ease and comfort, for we are all one in comfort.
But meditation so gothic. Quite honestly, I don't think you'll get much mileage out of a dreary old nun who was walled up.
I'll admit the concept of spending your whole life in one room in meditation and prayer is about as far removed from the perpetual motion of the 20th century as you could get. But I believe that the people of this age have just about reached the limit of their method of trying to escape unhappiness. They try to get away from it all, to keep on the move. They cram into cars, crowd onto airplanes. They just keep going. They don't travel because they want to arrive, just to get away from where they started. One day soon, they'll have to realize that what they're trying to get away from is something in themselves.
And I saw that nothing hindered me but sin. I wondered why the beginning of sin was not prevented by the great foreseeing wisdom of God. But Jesus said, sin had to be, but all shall be well, and every manner of thing shall be well.
Julian, in one room, possessing nothing, possessed the whole world.
You won't get very far with that one. People have got to the point that they think they can't exist without their possessions. Try to make them live without their central heating, their television, without electricity. They really believe they're necessary.
But what happens when you persuaded them that happiness is a fast car, an island in the sun, a swimming pool, and then when they've got it all, they find they're still not happy?
How naive you are. We simply tell them that what they need is a faster car, a sunnier island, a bigger swimming pool.
You tell them they can find peace and possessions, Beelzebub. Julian found that the whole of creation shrinks to a pebble compared to the vastness of the love of God.
In this he showed me a little thing, the size of a hazelnut in the palm of my hand, and it was round as a ball. I looked upon it with the eye of my understanding and thought, what may this be? And answer came, it is all that is made. I marveled at how it might last, for I thought it might suddenly have fallen to nothing, it was so small. And I was answered in my understanding, it lasts and ever shall because God loves it. And so all things have being by the love of God. In this little thing I saw three truths. The first is that God made it. The second is that God loves it. And the third, that God looks after it. We need to know how small creation is and to count it as not, if we are to love and to have God who is not created. For this is the cause why we are not at ease in heart and soul. that here we seek rest in things that are so little that there is no rest in them. And we do not know our God that is almighty, all wise, and all good. For God is true rest. Wouldst thou know thy Lord's meaning in this? Learn it well. Love is God's meaning. Who showed it thee? Love. What showed he thee? Love. Wherefore showed it he? Love. For love. And I saw full surely that before God ever made us, he loved us, which love was never slacked nor ever shall be. And in this love God hath done all works, and in this love God hath made all things profitable to us. And in this love our life is everlasting. In our making we had beginning, but the love wherein God made us was in God from without beginning, in which love we have our beginning. And all this we shall see in God without end.
Cora also composed this next piece called The Church Floor as a setting of a poem by George Herbert written in the 16th century during Elizabeth I's reign.
He thinks to spoil the room.
In closing, we invite you all to join in singing Love Divine. The text of the hymn is appropriate to Julian's philosophy and her belief in the power of divine love. The text was composed by Charles Wesley and the tune by Richard Pritchard, a 19th century Welsh hymn writer. It's number 315 in the LBW. 315.